So I think that realization has really helped me in seeing each person as an individual rather than as part of some particular class or ideology or race or age group. Everybody's so different. You know, it was an unintentional realization for me, but I think a very important and effective one in my practice as a nurse.
What's it like to make an abrupt midlife change to nursing and healthcare from an entirely different industry and then create a personally and professionally satisfying career out of that bold transition? Let's talk all about it with registered nurse and author Joe Downing right here on episode 473 of The Nurse Keith Show. Hey there, this is Nurse Keith. Happy Nurses Week. This podcast is all about you. It's about your personal and professional development, your career, and the healthcare system writ large. And I'm here to share education, ideas, diatribes, and informative interviews with some of the most inspiring people from the worlds of healthcare and nursing, medicine, entrepreneurship, and beyond. I love having you along for the ride, and I thank you from the bottom of my nurse podcaster's heart for being part of the growing Nurse Keith Nation. If you want to help other people find the show, I will ask you the same old boring request to leave a rating and review over on Apple Podcasts or Google or Amazon or Spotify, or become a patron at patreon.com/nursekeith. That's patreon.com/nursekeith. Even $2 a month is super awesome and helpful to keep the show running and keep things moving smoothly over here on this end of the microphone. I appreciate you all so much. The show notes are at nursekeith.com in the drop-down menu labeled podcasts, or the show notes are also in any app where you happen to find yourself listening. Like I said, we are here with registered nurse and author Joe Downing, and Joe's book, Wiping Ass in a Rolex, which we're going to talk about in a second, is awesome. And Joe, the first thing I want to ask you is, tell me what led you to this moment in your life where you were like, I'm going to leave the automobile industry and I'm going to become a registered nurse.
Yeah. Well, first of all, Keith, thanks for having me here. I'm a big fan. Love your podcast.
Thank
and
you.
Super excited to be here with you.
Thank you. So
it wasn't an overnight thing, Keith. I had been in the auto industry for 23 years. The last 15 years, I was in a management role. And it included 24/7 responsibility. I had profit and loss responsibility and phone at all times, day, night, weekends, holidays, and during my vacations. And I soon got into a, or I guess not soon, but gradually got into a situation where I could not dissociate from work. And I just became increasingly disillusioned with my career. And as a result, much less satisfied with my life. And I just decided I have to do something. I have to do something different. And I went on a journey of searching first, you know, prior to transitioning to nursing. I had to decide what I wanted to do. And fortunately for me, I was in a position where I had some options. So feel extremely grateful for that.
It's really a fascinating story. And your book, Wiping Ass in a Rolex, and the two S's are actually dollar signs, which I also think is entertaining and funny and thought provoking. But what I wanted to ask you was, you tell so many stories in the book, and one of the stories you tell is you're in this Chicago area church with your daughter. You're on a trip, I think, for her soccer team or a soccer tournament.
That's right.
And you're in this like wealthy kind of Tony Chicago suburb, and you're at this kind of, you know, upper class kind of church, and you're sort of paying attention, you're sort of not paying attention. But then you said you always listen to the priest's homily. That's sort of like your style when you're at church. You listen to the priest's message at the end. And there was a message you heard during that particular sermon that really spoke to the place you were in your life. And I'm curious, what did you find in that message that really kind of struck you?
Yeah, so it was really interesting. I was feeling sorry for myself at that time, you know, just between the combination of stress and the inability to dissociate from the work. And this is that, keep in mind, I'm 40 years old, so I'm not quick to learn things, obviously. But, you know, I just was in that mode of, well, if I work harder, I can make more and I can buy more stuff. And if I buy more stuff, I'll be happy. And here I am in this wealthy Chicago suburb, and there's a lot of people with a lot more stuff than me. And this priest was talking to the congregation about just, you know, putting your pursuing material things as opposed to pursuing a life of service, essentially. And it just spoke volumes to me. It's like, what am I doing? You know, what am I doing with my life? I got to figure out, you know, what is it that I should be doing with my life? Because pursuing material things, pursuing stuff is not working for me. And for some reason, it took this big, tall, excellent orator to kind of open my eyes. And his message, of course, was rooted in religion. And as you know, maybe we'll talk a little more. I'm not the most religious person in the world, but it did give me the impetus to do something different, to find something more purposeful with my life, to hopefully, you know, give me a more enriching career, number one, and two, just make my life all around better. And I don't know his name. I can't even tell you the name of the church, but I'll never forget the day and I'll never forget the way it made me feel. You know, I think I had mentioned it was a very, very hot day, but I got goosebumps when he started talking about, you know, purpose. And he was talking about finding God's purpose for us. But what I heard was I got to find a better purpose than the purpose I have now, which isn't all that meaningful.
Right. And in the book, you said something really interesting. I read your book really carefully because there's so many gems in it, quotes from other people, famous people, and also from your patients, interesting patients who you talk to, and then from you. And you said something about, you said, the older I get, the more cognizant I am that my time here is limited. I want to make the most of the time remaining. I want to live a good life. I want to leave the world just a little bit better than it would have been had I never been born. I don't want to solve all the world's problems. It will be remembered forever or even in 100 years. I just want to carry my share of the burden of life. So what does that mean to you to like carry your part of the burden of being a human on the planet?
Well, I guess at the end of every day, I just want to be able to look at myself in the mirror and say, you know, I gave more than I took, you know, so you don't have to look hard in our world to find people that need things, right? They have needs, they have wants, and to work to help people that need things, especially their health, is just time well spent. So I look at that as, you know, a burden in a way, in that, you know, I just can't sit on the sidelines, but it is the burdens in life that I think are the most beneficial once we pursue them and attack them with some intensity to help other people. And I guess that's the way I look at being a nurse. You know, we have patients that need us. And if I go out there and I work hard to help them, whatever the case may be, to help them regain their health, to help them pass on to, you know, a peaceful exit from this world, or to help the family members cope with the situation, these are all important things. And they're not easy things. And I just feel, you know, again, tremendous gratitude that I'm in a position where I can do that. And, you know, I guess what I meant was, you know, by leaving the world a little better place, I mean, it's just the little things, right? It's just the compassion to a patient that maybe isn't the nicest to deal with, or, you know, to pass it along to my kids. You know, I think I've set a good example for them, and they work hard to help other people as well. And you know, even with my coworkers, just try to, you know, smile a little bit, bring a positive attitude to the workplace. If I can do that, I think I'm making the world a little better. At least I hope I am.
I think you are.
You know, it's not big things. You know, it's just the small things. And again, you know, I think I had wrote that 10 years after I'm gone or some finite number, nobody will even know I've existed at all, you know, except maybe a couple remaining family members. But it doesn't matter. You know, it's just the little things you leave behind. If somebody can be inspired by your actions that help make the world a little better, then maybe they'll pass it on. And, you know, it just could lead to a cycle of improvement and a better world, ideally.
So in your book, you delve into a lot. And you talk about this one nursing assistant who is just amazing. And you talk about how she really gave you some gifts in the course of your work together in terms of helping you with a patient who was a terminal wean. And you promised the mother of this young woman that someone would be with her when she died. And, you know, you were really doing your best, even though you knew that was a promise you shouldn't have made. And you also write about patients who are not quite so nice and some very difficult encounters. And there's this one cranky old guy. Everyone tells you he's an asshole. Everyone's afraid of him and no one wants to talk to him. But there's a way in which you approached him that actually worked. And I recently did an episode of this podcast about how to deal with difficult patients.
Yes, I listened to it.
Yeah. Oh, good. And what lessons have you learned about approaching people who, you know, they're maybe not being so nice to you, but you still feel like you have a job to do and you have a way to approach them that might be efficacious?
Well, it's interesting because one of the stories that I tell is about a patient, that really, really difficult person. And, you know, what I learned from my interaction with him, I had initial success with him right off the bat just by listening, getting him to talk about himself. And I found that people love to talk about themselves, and I'm no exception. But you know, when you have a patient that's struggling, when they're angry, when they're mad, if you can find some common ground to talk about something that they are interested in, they start talking. And I just feel that that's tremendously therapeutic for them to, you know, start chatting with you. And it kind of breaks the ice, kind of develops a camaraderie and a sense of trust between the two of you. But the other thing I learned there, and I told in this story, this was one of my very first patients as a student nurse. And I felt like I had broken the ice with this guy. And I kind of made a difference. I could tell I did a good job for him. And, you know, I got a lot of accolades from the nursing instructor. It's like, you know, telling me how difficult this guy was. And he's a regular to the unit and most of the staff won't deal with him, and that she's dealt with him for more than a year. And I learned more about him in one shift than she found out in several shifts with him. So I felt really great about that. But then, you know, as time went on, I was thinking that I still thought this guy was a jerk. You know, I was very judgmental about him. I passed judgment on him because I, you know, just thought he was a victim. He played that victim card handily. But, you know, the more I thought about it, is he's probably got a reason he does that, you know, and I don't know what that reason is. And for me to just pass quick judgment to say, oh, this guy's a jerk, that's not good nursing. You know, that's just not. Even though I got away with that one, I even got patted on the back a little bit, I realized that, you know what, I got a lot of improving to do. And it's a constant struggle, as you know, the conversation you had with, I forgot her name, but on dealing with difficult patients, it really struck a bell because it happens all the time. I mean, just yesterday I had a difficult patient, and at the end of the day, it's like, you know, probably could have did better. You know, I did pass some judgment there, and I shouldn't. You know, it's really part of being a good nurse is to not pass judgment on people, as you just never know what they've gone through to arrive at the situation that they're in at that point. You know, keep in mind, we take care of people at their worst quite often, right? You know, sickness, hopelessness, you know, withdrawal from drugs and alcohol or psychiatric disorders, you name it. You know, we deal with a lot of people at their less than best situations.
Right, exactly. And there's one story you tell about this guy who's like bellowing and yelling. He's so loud and, you know, everyone can hear him all over the hospital. And you decide you're the one who's sent in to talk to him. So All the curtains are drawn around his bed and you decide like, okay, I'm going to disarm this guy. And you go over to the bed and you whip the curtain open really fast. And you say, okay, where's this shy guy who everyone's talking about who won't say a word, you know? And all of a sudden you kind of caught him up short because you met him where he was and you kind of threw it back at him and disarmed him immediately, which I thought was
that
brilliant.
That could have blew up in my face, but it didn't. It worked out just fine. Disarmed him right off the bat, kind of shocked him a bit. And, we developed our little rapport. Mm-hmm. And, I think that's just it is a skill that we as nurses have to continue to work at. And that is meeting the patient where they are. Because like your former guests and difficult patients would say, you know, we have to listen to them, right? And it's hard to listen to them if we're talking to them the way we talk to one of our friends, and they're from a totally different situation than we are, that they've grown up different socioeconomic status, you know, whatever the case may be. It takes a lot of work because there's so many different types of people out there. But, you know, with that gentleman, it went a long way. You know, I met him where he was. I listened to his stories, and his stories weren't of this world. You know, he was fabricating almost all of it. And I knew it by reading his chart. But, you know, it's that talking, that talkesthesia, as we call it, that helped him get through the procedure we had to do without, you know, causing too much of a ruckus. So,
that was
a success for me.
That was successful. And you know, one thing I really appreciated about your book is you were baldly honest and boldly honest about your own judgments about people, like you just mentioned, and your own shortcomings. And, you know, I'm going to be 60 this year, so I'm getting older too. And I'm curious, from your perspective, just as a human being, you know, what value do you see in such, you know, honest, clear-eyed self-assessment and just like owning your stuff at any point in life? And I'm just curious for you at this juncture.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, you know, it's important every step of the way. But I was not very good at it at all. For a long, long time. And I can't even tell you what the single thing was, or even the process was that I used to become more self-reflective. But oh my gosh, I can't tell you just how beneficial it has been for me. And not to say that I still don't have a long way to go, but I just think that from a state of mental health to, you know, analyze your own thoughts and understand that, you know, maybe you can get out of your own head by looking at yourself in the way you behave. So maybe looking at your behaviors and your actions and focusing less on your own internal dialogue has just been really beneficial to me. So I guess what I'm saying is I kind of try to step out of myself and look at myself through my patient's eyes or through my coworker's eyes, things of that nature. And like to give you an example, when I leave the end of my shift, one of my coworkers and I, we walk back to our cars together, and I was complaining about something, you know, something that got under my skin, and I'm living within my head again. And she says, you know, I read this book. I think it would maybe help you get a better hold of yourself. And, you know, she mentioned the title of my book, and I thought it was very, very funny. She's, you know, using my own words back against me. But, you know, I don't know if that made sense, but what I'm trying to say is to get less in my own thoughts about how I am, how I'm feeling, and more about the actions that I'm taking and how that is perceived by those around me.
Mm-hmm. Well said. And you use the Stoic philosophers and others as examples of this type of self-reflection. And there's also something in your book that really struck me that I've been thinking about the last couple of days. And you talked about coming into nursing from the auto industry with very kind of clear ideas about people, about the world, about your place in it, about who you were, about who was who and, you know, what was what. And then you came to this realization at some point during the story. I don't remember what the crossroads was, but you talk about this concept of having a small identity, which I really resonated with. And I wanted you to share with the audience a little bit about what you mean by that, because I think it's a really important concept, actually.
Yeah. So I got this idea from a gentleman named Paul Graham. I think I got the name right. And he's a venture capitalist. He's like one of those super wealthy guys that's not particularly well known. But I read this article and it was about having a small identity. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is important, especially for a nurse and dealing with so many people of so many different persuasions and thought processes and ideologies. But the idea is to just not be able to be labeled by somebody. For instance, you know, I'm sure we all know people that you would look at it and immediately the first thing you'd say about them is their political persuasion. Oh, that person's a progressive, or that person's a MAGA Republican. That person is a devout Muslim because you see them doing their prayers five times a day, or they're a Christian. You know, this real strong identities one way or another. And I'm not saying any of it's bad. I'm not trying to say that. What I'm trying to say is that for me and in my role as a nurse, I want to be non-identifiable in that I don't want to start listening to somebody that I fundamentally disagree with and immediately shut them off because I'm living within some ideology. I would rather put my ideology aside and listen with an open mind. And I think it's just really hard to listen with an open mind when you are an ideologue, a person that can be readily identified as of a particular identity. And again, I'm not saying it's impossible, but for me, I think it was important because there was a period in my life where I certainly could be immediately identified. You know, I was the libertarian capitalist, you know, nothing better than that, right? I don't look at the world quite the same way anymore.
I appreciate that. And I was reflecting on myself in the course of reading your book, and your book had a profound effect on me in many different ways. And I had a couple cries during your book too, because there were some very moving passages, and especially about some of your patient encounters and the deaths and the blood and gore, which are moving, but also the human factor, because your book really revolves around the humanity of nursing. It's really your own humanity and the humanity of the people around you. And, you know, I was thinking about myself, and I was just thinking about how I have opinions about things, but I tend to not want to argue them with people. And it's one of the things I've cultivated over the years as I've gotten older. It's like, I don't need to get my point across. It's not that important to me to make sure someone understands that my opinion is my opinion. And I think that's part of, I think, the small identity part. And I think as a nurse, being a little bit more of a blank slate is what you're saying, like coming to an encounter kind of open. Is that kind of the notion?
Yes, absolutely. Coming in, as a blank slate to the situation. Of course, you know, that's impossible to be a complete blank slate, but to be as open-minded as possible and receptive as possible to your patient's position or their family's position, I think it's important. You know, it's the only way to really perform great care, right? You have to kind of understand where they're coming from. And if you are so fixated in your own ideology that you're going to immediately shut them off, you're just not going to develop that rapport with the patient or their family that they deserve from you.
That's true. And you give plenty of examples of ways where you could have blown it really bad, and places where you felt like you didn't do quite as well as you could have. And I love your honesty about it. And when we come back from the break, I don't even want to take a break, but when we come back from the break, I want to have you read a passage from the book, and there's some other aspects of the story that I want to touch base on. So please hang in there with us. We'll be right back for the second half of this episode, number 473 of the Nurse Keith Show, with registered nurse and author Joe Downing. And welcome back to the second half of the episode. We're here again with friend of the pod and my new friend and colleague, Joe Downing. And Joe, prior to the break, we were talking about this whole notion of like having a smaller identity, being a blank slate, and approaching patients and encounters in a way that just we meet people where they are. But one of the things I want to ask you, which is just about the book itself. So The title is funny, it's thought provoking, and makes you think like, what's that about? So
yeah.
So the title of the book, like I said at the beginning, is Wiping Ass in a Rolex, and the two S's are dollar signs. And I'm curious where that came from, what that means to you.
Yeah. So, all right. So here's the story on the title. So I had been an engineer for a long time, and I decided I was going to go become a nurse. And in order to do that, I was going to enter a, I guess it was a 12-month accelerated Bachelor of Science in Nursing program designed only for people that had existing bachelor's degrees, which I did have. However, all of my science classes were very old, so I had to retake them all. So I went back to school at age whatever I was, 40-something, 42 years old, went back to a community college, never had stepped foot in a community college in my life, to take biology 101. And this walk into the classroom and I sit down and I'm in my work clothes and my, you know, professional attire. And this young kid walks in, sits next to me and says, "Zup." And like, "Hello," I said to him. And he looks over at my wrist and he's like, "Dude, is that a Rolex?" And I'm like, "Yeah, it's a Rolex." He's like, "Can I try it on?" And I'm like, I didn't know what to say. Fortunately, the instructor walked in at that time and, you know, we all kind of got in order and he lectured us for about an hour. And this, you know, Mr. Rolex sitting next to me there was, you know, interjecting at every juncture to ask some question that was just not appropriate. So anyway, the break comes around and, Mr. Rolex sitting next to me, he's like, "Yeah, dude, I'm going to be a nurse. I'd really love to buy a Rolex, but you can't wipe ass in a Rolex." I'm like, so that's where the title came from.
Oh my gosh. And you were like, "What am I doing here?"
I was like, "Oh my God." I think the phrase I used, "I've been in community college for 45 minutes and I'm dumber already."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I did clarify it that it actually got quite good after that. I learned a lot. The instruction was great. Fellow students that were all 20 plus years younger than me were great as well.
That's really awesome. I love that. It's a great story. I love that story. Speaking of stories, I'd love for you to read a passage because there's nothing like hearing an author read from their own writing. So would you read us a passage?
I sure will. So I'm going to just have to set this up a little bit.
Please.
I'm going to read part of my chapter on the pandemic, but just to put this into context here. So this, I started this essay in March of 2020, April of 2020, right at the beginning of the pandemic. And I am an amateur, well, I guess I'm technically a professional natural bodybuilder. I compete in bodybuilding competitions. And I had a competition coming up the last weekend in March of 2020. And I had been dieting for 6 months. So for a 6 month period, nothing passed my lips that wasn't pre-programmed. So I was basically starving myself to death by this point, was super cranky. And I had just received word that the state of Michigan was being shut down and that my competition was not going to occur. So I was very, very disappointed and really just feeling sorry for myself. But the last day the restaurants were open in the state, my wife and I went out and got a pizza and a couple of beers and I felt a lot better, but that I just wanted to put it into context. So okay. I'm going to start reading here. My feelings of despair started to subside after eating a pizza and having a couple of beers the last night the restaurants were open in the state. No competition was coming up now, so there was no reason to keep dieting. All of my self-pity quickly evaporated as both the hospitals I was working at started to fill up with COVID patients. I started to work a ton of hours since I didn't have much else to do, and I knew my skill set was going to be in demand since so many of these patients were ending up in the ICU. I would work my shift in the procedural area, pick up shifts in our temporary COVID ICU at the university, and then head to my part-time job and take care of more COVID patients. I was up to my eyeballs in COVID. For some reason, I just never even considered the fact that I could get really sick from this virus. I guess I had a false sense of security initially. Once again, I am dumb, but lucky. The first week we really started to get slammed with COVID patients, my part-time job ran very short on N95 masks. I did an entire shift caring for two very sick COVID patients, and that all they had available for me to wear was a pediatric N95. I finally just went maskless for the entire shift because my glasses fogged up so bad I couldn't function. For the first couple of weeks, it was an adrenaline rush, taking care of the sickest of the sick. They were on ventilators, as well as chemical paralytics and tons of other IV drugs. It was my kind of nursing. I was having fun. I was working hard to save people's lives, having fun until I began to notice that these people that progressed to that point were all dying. When I say they were all dying, I'm not exaggerating much. There's no fun in that. The fun was gone, but the work still had to be done. The smaller hospital I worked at part-time was really stretched for resources. The nurses on the units had to communicate with the families directly over the phone or Zoom. At the university, that didn't typically fall under the nurse's responsibility. So up until the pandemic, I never really shied away from talking to the patient's families, even in the most uncomfortable situations. This was a new level of discomfort, however. I had to tell these family members that their loved ones were dying. They could not see them. There was no visitors allowed in the hospital. Complete lockdown. I was essentially telling them that they had already seen their loved one alive for the last time in many situations. That wasn't the worst part. When the family knows their loved one has a really high chance of dying, and you have to make that final call to let them know they are gone, that's the worst. One call I'll never be able to forget was telling a woman that her husband, who was approximately my own age, had died. There's no way to erase that shriek and uncontrollable sobbing that followed. I still hear it as I write these words. No, 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 over and over. She couldn't stop. It took so much effort just to stay on the line with her. I had never met her. I'd really never met her husband. He was on a ventilator the first time I became acquainted with him. I had another patient in the next room, and I still had a chance to help save that patient. How do I get to that patient and still be compassionate to this wife whose hopeless sorrow at that moment was ripping at my insides? Nursing is about prioritization. How do you prioritize this? Take care of the living, but almost certain to die? Or console the one that has just lost their soulmate? There was no right answer. That was the theme of the pandemic for me. There was no right answer for hardly anything. And that's where I'll stop reading. But, you know, just so you don't think it's all doom and gloom.
It's not.
I started every chapter with a quote from a famous person. And the quote at the beginning of the pandemic chapter is from Helen Keller. And it is, although the world is full of suffering, it is also full of the overcoming of it. And that's what I ultimately like to remember about the pandemic is, you know, as terrible as it was, there were still bright spots, you know, mm-hmm. to see within it.
Exactly. And that's a really beautiful passage. And I didn't work the front line in that particular way because I've never been an acute care nurse. So that wasn't mm-hmm. my place. I eventually did lots of testing, you know, and vaccinations and all that sort of thing. But I was not doing that work that you and so many other people did, which I found so noble and selfless. And, you know, your book is a lot about kind of like taking this macroscopic level view of the world and then kind of zeroing in on the human to human, you know, the uniqueness of each person and that connection you have with that person. Either it's the sobbing wife on the other end of the phone, it's the mom of the woman who you know, you're doing a terminal wean because she's brain dead, or it's when you're doing, you know, your elbows deep in blood and there's people screaming and, you know, that you're not doing a good enough job. They're out in the hallway. You know, there's all these stories. So how do you take that macro view and then kind of like crunch it down into the micro so that you can continue doing the work you do and just do the best job you possibly can and approach each relationship and moment, you know, with an open mind and open heart? How do you do
that? Right. Well, you know, that's one of the things I learned along the way here. You know, I started writing more as a therapy for myself. But, you know, as I was writing more and more and talking to more and more patients, I started to be faced with the question of what makes a good life, right? And at some point along the way, I was like, man, I can talk to all these people. What an envious position to be in. I can talk to tons of people about what drives them, you know, what makes their life worth living or not worth living in some cases. And I figured I could, you know, I'm a very analytical person. I figure I could just, you know, make some tidy bar chart or something about what makes a good life. And the more I worked at that, the more I talked to people, the more situations I was in, the more I realized that that's just not possible. We all see the world so differently from one another. We all put value on totally different things. I don't think there is any ubiquitous definition of a good life or a ubiquitous definition of you know, what drives us, what makes life worth living. So I think that realization has really helped me in seeing each person as an individual rather than as part of some particular class or ideology or race or age group. Everybody's so different, you know, and, you know, it was an unintentional realization for me, but I think a very important and effective one in my practice as a nurse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's one quote in your book, I don't know who said it, it was a famous person or not famous person, that happiness is a wonderful symptom, but a terrible goal.
Yes. Yes. And I love that one.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, I was just thinking about, I have a daughter that's getting married soon. And, you know, at the end of every speech you hear, you know, may you live happily ever after. Well, that's, nobody does that, right? You know, I haven't met the happily ever after person yet. So really, I think what we're all searching for is a life where we can look at ourselves in the mirror and say, yeah, I'm doing good. You know, I'm doing good. And happiness will be at least partially a symptom of that.
I like that. And it's funny, a week from today when this episode comes out, I'm actually getting married 7 days after this
episode. Oh, well, congratulations. Fantastic. So, yeah,
there you go.
All right.
Thank you. And there's this patient who said to you something. He said, if I were to give you some advice, Joe, I'd say this. Give your family and friends darn good reason to like you. And if some people don't like you, give them a reason to respect you. And
yes,
it sounds like that also meant a lot to you of all the things it that did. Different patients said to you.
Yep. I'll never forget that, gentleman. I just to put that in a bit of context, when I was still a student nurse and I had met him and I had he was on a ventilator, big fella, mid 70s, scruffy white beard, white hair. And he just looked at me. You know, where we were talking earlier about, you know, you paint this picture of what somebody is, but you really don't know what they're like. You shouldn't make assumptions. So my assumption was he's this, you know, blue collar granddad sitting in a chair, sipping on his whiskey every night. And as it turned out, he was this fabulously successful entrepreneur and just such an interesting man. And I could just tell, you know, he knew his end was coming soon. And he was not loving life at that moment. He was miserable. You know, once we got him off the ventilator. So, you know, once I actually got to meet him and talk to him, he was just struggling mightily, you know, pain and just, he knew the end was near, but he said, I'm not happy. I'm not happy at all. How could I be happy? I got these sores on my legs. I'm in pain. I can barely move and it's never going to get better. But he said, I'm satisfied. And he said, you know, I've lived a good life, worked hard, made tremendous mistakes, hurt the people that love me, but in the end, I've done right by them. And I thought, man, that's a fantastic way to be able to look at the end of your life there. Not, oh, I've lived a life of blissful happiness, because nobody does that. Mm-hmm. But it was a life of satisfaction. And it just touched me and I'll never forget him. That was one of the best lessons I learned as a nurse.
Yeah, that was really, I love that. I mean, I love all the stories, but that was a really good one. And we have to wind down here. But I have one more question I wanted to ask you before we kind of move into the final segment. But
sure.
And this pertains a lot to nursing, because we can get caught in patterns of behavior, the ways we do things. And you know that those dangerous words in healthcare, I wrote something once about the 7 most dangerous words in healthcare, which is, but that's the way it's always been done, you know, something along those lines.
Yeah.
And in one passage, you talk about a person who basically, what did you say? You said confuses 35 years of experience with 1 year of experience repeated 34 times.
Yes.
And
yes.
How does that, like, how do you relate that to nursing when we just feel like we can do the same thing over and over and everything's just fine?
Yeah. So that was actually a lesson that I learned in the auto industry. It was, somebody had, we had a big manager that liked to use that statement. I got 35 years of experience. And, you know, somebody leaned over on me and said that, you know, he confuses 35 years with 1 year repeated 34 times. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I thought about that during nursing school. Actually, we had a professor who was not politically correct in any way. And she said to us, don't be dumb nurses. And, you know, you can't even say that these days. You know, it's, you know, you shouldn't be saying things like that. But I knew exactly what she meant. She didn't mean dumb. She meant lacking continuous improvement. And, you know, we all start off kind of dumb. You know, I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't even know how to pronounce half of the terms. And, you know, I pronounced all the medication names wrong. I didn't even know how to, you know, effectively take a blood pressure, start an IVs. Incompetent at all of that. But I think a lot of us just arrive at a point where we're comfortable and our skill set is adequate. And it's hard to keep improving. But it's important because, you know, our patients deserve that. They don't deserve a good nurse. They deserve a great nurse. And, you know, that it's just that attitude of a continuous mindset and getting out of that. Well, we've always done it that way. Mm-hmm. You know, and I tell you, I'm guilty of it too. You know, we just had this come up in my department, you know, where we, you know, I don't need to get into the details of it, but basically we've been saying that we have this in our policy. We have this in our policy. So we can't do this because it's in the policy that we can't do that. And finally, I don't even know what possessed me to do it, but I'm like, where? Where is it in our policy?
Show me.
We found out it wasn't there.
Wow.
So, you know, it's just, again, you know, just continuously improve and easier said than done. And believe me, I was just thinking about that today in anticipation of this. It's like, what have I done to get better lately? And I was just thinking, well, not enough. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to do something about that starting tomorrow.
Well, good life lesson for the personal and professional. And on that note, I want to seek into the final four questions I ask all my guests. And
okay.
I learned this technique from Alan Alda from his podcast, Clear and Vivid, having these kind of like universal questions you ask everyone. And the first one is, and I think you've already answered it, but I just want to circle back to it, which is, how do you define success in life, in personal life and professional life?
Yeah. So I guess I would define success as using the skills and the tools that I have to make the world a little bit better place, a little bit better than it would be if I had never been alive.
Good one. I love it. Okay. The second question, and you talk about so many awesome people in this book and you quote a lot of awesome people, but I want to zero in. Who is one person who's inspired you, who you really look to as a person who's just like one of these shining examples in your life? They could be living or dead, famous, or someone, you know, none of us would ever have met because it's just someone from your personal life.
You know, so right now I'm on a Nietzsche kick. You know, I'm a big fan of philosophy and I decided Friedrich. I was going to take.
Yes.
Huh? Yeah. Friedrich. So I'm taking Friedrich Nietzsche and I'm taking about a 3 month, deep dive into him. And I just, you know, what inspires me about him is he just thinks outside the box. And I think they say that you can find a quote from Nietzsche on anything, but I have one right here that I've been thinking about a lot and on my journey, and not to say that I've arrived at a destination, but this one always spoke to me, and it's, I overcame myself, the sufferer. I carried my own ashes to the mountains. I invented a brighter flame for myself. And I don't know, just love that one, you know? So yeah, Nietzsche, just always something to make you think. That's what I love about that. His
good
work.
One. Yeah, it's a good one. I haven't read Nietzsche in a long time.
It's not easy. It's not an easy read.
No, it's like reading Kierkegaard or something like that.
Yeah.
So this next question, you'll have to go in a different direction maybe, but I usually ask my guests for a book or even a movie. It doesn't really matter. Just something that is like one of those things that has been a guiding light or something that has always been a place they return to in their life.
Yeah. So this is going to sound kind of weird from a man my age, but the movie is A Princess Bride.
Really? Interesting. Tell me
which is, you know, from whatever that was, 1987 or something. Yeah. So there's a really famous scene in the movie, you know, where the character is trying to avenge the death of his father, and he's saying over and over again, "Hello, my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die." And everybody loves that scene. Most famous scene from the movie. However, that's not what struck me. What struck me is after he avenged his father's death, he said, "Now that I've avenged my father's death, I don't know what to do with my life." Basically, what he was saying is he's been on a singular purpose. And now that that purpose has been achieved, now what? And I just thought of being able to work in nursing. There is no singular purpose. It's never ending. People will always need help. And I will never be faced with that situation that character in the movie was faced with. There will be no end, right? There will be a time when I can't do my job anymore and I'll have to, you know, hang it up. But between now and then, I'm going to go for it as hard as I can.
And okay, last question, Joe.
Yes.
If you, Joe Downing, were named king of the world tomorrow and you had ultimate power to do everything, so everything that you ever wanted to do, what would be your first act as king to improve the lives of your subjects, bearing in mind that you could do it all eventually?
Yeah. Well, the first thing would be a panic attack, because obviously I wouldn't want that kind of responsibility. But
All right. After the panic attack.
Yeah. I'm all about freedom. What I think is the most important thing is maximizing human potential. No matter where that person stands, how can we maximize their potential? And I guess what I would do is I would put a task force in place from people from all different persuasions and ideologies with the task of report back to me in 2, 3, 4 months on what are some of the best ways that we could maximize human potential.
Wow, that is awesome. Because then everything would be born from that, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. I know that's, I talked about not being an ideologue, but, or a dreamer, but I don't know. Sometimes you got to dream a little, right?
I just gave your permission and you'd look great in a crown, I got to say. I bet your wife would hopefully agree. So
yeah.
Joe, this has been amazing. I've been looking forward to this so much. Your book is really moving and I enjoyed it so much, and people can find it on Amazon. There's a Kindle version and there's a print version. It's called Wiping Ass in a Rolex. It's easy to find.
Right.
And I am so glad you reached out to me. I'm so glad we've met. I hope we stay connected, and I hope a lot of nurses out there read your book, and I appreciate you being here so much. This has been really awesome.
Well, I've really enjoyed it, Keith. Thanks so much for having me, and keep up the good work. I'm going to continue to be a fan.
Well, there you have it. Thanks for listening to this awesome episode of the Nurse Keith Show. Remember, the show notes will be at nursekeith.com and on any app where you're listening. Please go to Amazon, look up Wiping Ass in a Rolex by Joe Downing and buy a copy. I hope you feel uplifted and empowered from this episode. I hope it's given you a lot to think about. If you need holistic career coaching to elevate your career, look no further than nursekeith.com and Nurse Keith Coaching. Mention the show, of course, and get 10% off your first coaching package. We are proud members of the Health Podcast Network, so please head over to healthpodcastnetwork.com, and we are jointly produced by the wonderful Rob Johnston of 520R Podcasting. And before we say goodbye, I'll leave you with this quote, which I think is quite aligned with a lot of the things that Joe talked about today. It's by the musician Robert Fripp. "May my living honor my parents. May my living repay the debt of my existence." Anyway, be well, dig deep, seek joy, keep in touch. This is Nurse Keith saying adios till next time from beautiful Santa Fe, New Mexico, and the inimitable future king of the world, Joe Downing, saying arrivederci from
Gibraltar, Michigan. Thanks for having me, Keith. It's been great.
Thank you, Joe. Thanks to everyone for listening. And we will catch you, of course, on the proverbial flip side.